Hello and welcome to the Current Affairs Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Davis. I am here with amusements and managing editor, Lyta Gold. Hello, Lyta.
Hi.
Listeners, you are very lucky to be listening right now because something big is happening across American politics. And that big thing is the theme of this week's episode. A new generation rises, and they are not rising quietly, towing the party line, hiding their true self, and slowly moving up the ranks. Rather, they are primarying party leaders, taking on local machines, saying what they believe, sharing who they authentically are, and doing it all without fear. You've heard about them, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, and just this past week, we celebrate Queens DA-elect Tiffany Caban.
Woo!
Want to know, listeners, who is next? Then keep listening, because we have who is next right here on the show. Welcome, Michaela Wilkes.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So glad to have you on. Michaela, you are 28 years old, a daughter of Maryland, and now a candidate for Congress, facing off in the primary next year against the second most powerful figure in the House of Representatives, House Majority Leader, and 38-year incumbent, Steny Hamilton Hoyer. Yes, I looked up his middle name. So, Michaela, let's get started. Tell us your story. Where do you come from? What inspired you to decide as a 28-year-old to run for Congress?
Yeah, so I grew up in Maryland all of my life. I've lived in District 5 pretty much all of my life since I was about 9 or 10 years old. My mom raised me. My aunts helped to raise me. You know, it really took a village to raise my brother and my sister and myself. But I'm running because there are so many people in my community and our communities who are left out of the conversations happening in Congress. I feel like we're not being properly represented, and I'm running because we need someone who will look out for our interests and not corporate interests, which is what we've been getting for the past 40 years. And actually, it didn't start out with me wanting to be in politics. I didn't start out as someone who, you know, was so much into politics. I actually started out wanting to become a psychologist. I was actually majoring in psychology because of my run-in with the criminal justice system at such a young age when I was in high school, being incarcerated in juvenile detention for like skipping school, running away from home versus actually getting the help that I needed. I was being punished when I actually needed help. And so that's what inspired me to major in psychology, and so that I can work in juvenile detention centers and prisons and help rehabilitate them instead of contribute to the system that exploits these people. But when I got older, as an adult, I grasped the fact that this is a whole system that's put in place for us. And it's set up like as soon as we make these mistakes, this system is waiting for us. And I didn't really quite grasp that until I started getting pulled over by the police once I started driving. And it would start out as something so small as maybe a crack in your windshield, or you have a headlight out or a brake light. And then at the time, back then when all this was happening, I wasn't making that much money. I maybe was making $7 and some change an hour when I was working. But when you can't pay these tickets, your license is suspended. I had no idea that you could actually go to jail for driving on a suspended license until it happened to me. And at that moment, that's when I was like, you know what, something needs to change. And I realized that our criminal justice system was flawed. Not even just with that, but even when you are incarcerated for these short amount of times and you see people who are stuck in jail because they can't pay $150 bail for small things such as maybe a nick bag or a dime bag of weed, or maybe they had to shoplift because they couldn't afford to buy food for their children. And these things are being criminalized. And it's basically saying, if you don't have money, you stay in jail. So it's things like that that made me really want to get into politics and made me want to join the conversation and legislation and policy to help these people instead of helping the corporations that profit off of their struggles.
Michaela, this is amazing. And it's an amazing story, especially given that Congress is usually made up of types of people from a very small swath of the population. I found some research out there that said as of 2014, half of all members of Congress are millionaires. Most people do not have this background. This seems to be an important part of your candidacy, not just the messages and policies and vision you're advancing, but also just that your history embodies the experience of most Americans, frankly. You will truly be representative of what tens of millions of Americans go through that no one in Congress has ever experienced. Not many people that.
Yeah, but that is what we need. Like, that's what we're missing. And I always say this, I've said it so many times, that representation matters. It matters so much because to have that firsthand experience, for me, it makes it so much more than politics. Like, it's not political at all for me. It's 100% personal because I am the people that I'm fighting for. I'm not on the outside. I'm on the inside fighting with them. You know, this is my life. This is my sister, my mom, my cousin, my brother, my neighbors, the people I work with, my classmates. It's everyone all around me. And we're in this together. And I feel like, why not me? Like, we need someone that has been through what we've been through so that we can fight for us from the inside. We know what's going on. We know how these policies affect us. We know we're being overlooked. So we need someone who's going to get in there. I know for me personally, when I'm elected in the Congress, I would not be able to sleep at night knowing that I'm denying my neighbor and my family members of health care, or that I'm keeping them in jail for bail money, that, you know, it's all these things that are hurting us. And for me, like I said, it's personal. And that's what sets me aside from a typical Congress person, is because I have lived that life. I can't think of one congressperson who's ever gotten their food stamps cut off because they started making $7.25 an hour. But I have. I know that struggle, and I know what we need to get out of it.
So, Michaela, you've said in interviews that you were inspired to run partly by AOC, her sudden victory. Can you expand on that? What was it about that happening that, like, really was like, okay, yeah, I can do this?
What about AOC made me think that I can do this? It's just seeing someone that comes from a background similar to mine, and the perspective that she is a real regular person. Like, yes, she went to college, she got higher education, but she lived her life as a regular person. She knows the struggles of everyday people. And that is where I feel like me and her align in a way. And that is what inspired me, because when you look at Congress and you look at the people in Congress, I don't see people who look like me. And finally, when AOC was elected, I was like, wow, there's someone that looks like me, like I can do this.
I read in an article, I love the origin story of how you chose to run. You know, a lot of people get to run because some like party leader goes up to them and said, you check all of our boxes and you are towing the party line, so we're going to get a group of people behind you right now and set you up to run. But you started by Googling, what do you need to run for Congress? How old do you have to be? What do you have to do? A little in-house ad for Google that resulted in you deciding to run. Can you tell us about that first moment when you decided to do that?
Yeah, so actually, I was actually at work and I was just reading about everything that was going on, like with Trump and everything that was going on in Congress. And I'm just like, oh my goodness. And I think this was like around the time of the government shutdown, or a little bit more afterwards. And I was just at my desk and I was like, I'm tired of this. I was like, something has to change. And then I was just like, you know what? If she can do it, I can do it. I always, like, when I got into politics, it was always my goal to want to change legislation and be a part of the legislative process. But because, like I said, they make it so intimidating, I thought that I had to wait until I finished law school and waited until I got my degree and everything. But I was just like, you know what? Let me go on Google and just see. And I just Googled and I was like, yeah, let me Google, what are the requirements to run for Congress in the state of Maryland? And then once I saw what the requirements was, I called up to the Board of Elections in Annapolis. I called up there and I'm like, hey, what do I need to do to run for a House of Representatives in my district? And she was like, well, you need a $150 filing fee and a Maryland state ID. And I was like, okay, what else? And she was like, that's it. And then your name's on the ballot. And I was like, wow, really? And she was like, yeah. So I think the filing date was February the 5th. I filed, I believe, on February the 8th or the 9th, whatever day that Friday fell on. And then my name, I guess, will be on the ballot in 2020 now.
It's funny because the process technically is quite easy, as you're saying, but the DCC makes it awfully difficult for actual progressive candidates to run. They have the Rolodex test where you're supposed to raise a certain amount of money just by calling people on your Rolodex, which, again, very outdated, but also like the idea that you have wealthy people you can just call.
Yes.
Yes. The money problem is a real problem because you're not taking corporate money. How do you intend to compensate for that? What are your plans there?
My campaign and my race is strictly grassroots funded. I'm not taking any money from any corporate PACs. Thank God that we, in the state of Maryland, to run for Congress, we don't have to get a certain amount of signatures and we don't have to raise like thousands of dollars like other districts do in other areas. So we were pretty lucky with that in that aspect. Really, it all comes down to reaching out to the people and just showing people that you're for them. Because ultimately, if you are working for the people and you have every intention to continue to do that, then the people will donate to you. Which actually, interestingly, I went to an event the other day and an elected official, I won't name her name, but she actually tried to talk me out of the race.
Really?
Yes, telling me that she works closely with Steny and that he's done the best that he can and seniority is everything. If we lose seniority, we have nothing. And so when she told me he was doing the best that he can, I was like, I said, well, how do you feel about power plants being built in Brandywine, Maryland, where the population is only roughly around 7,000 and about 70% of that population is African-American and they already have power plants there? I was like, how do you feel about that? I was like, how do you feel about him denying people health care and taking contributions from pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies? And I was like, and then also his top contributor is Exelon. I was like, he gets money from these corporations and he endorses and sponsors policies in the name of their interests. And you know what she told me? She said the people don't donate. And she asked me, when is the last time you contributed to your congressman? And I told her, if he worked for us and he worked in our interests, I'm pretty sure that people would donate to him. And I told her, I said, did you know that Steny Hoyer, less than 2% of his contributions from the first quarter came from small donors? Only $185 came from small contributors. Within about 4 or 5 days of me announcing, I made over $5,000, all small donors. That is what it's all about, and that's grassroots.
Amen. It's like the corporate donations drive out the small donations. It's why would I want to donate to like have you just do what Exelon wants? You know, I want to donate when I have a choice. Part of our goal with this podcast is to educate listeners on the like how the sausage is made in different things. So we've done how the sausage is made on starting to run for office. But now that you're running, you've gotten big press stories in BuzzFeed, in The Intercept. You're on the radar of the Maryland machine because they're trying to get you to stop. So that's always the first step. Once they're trying to kick you out, that means you're doing something. They're paying attention. What is your day-to-day life now running? Is it mostly trying to raise money from these small donors? Is it mostly having events? Are you starting to do field yet? What is it like to start putting a campaign together 1 year out?
At this point in time, we are putting together field events. Me personally, I'm ready to go out and start canvassing. That's really important to me at this point, specifically because the incumbent Hoyer has been in office for so long and he has so much name recognition in this area that it's going to take starting out early to getting out, knocking on doors and canvassing. Whether, I mean, it's early now, so of course this will have to be a continuous thing. But I think it's really important now to get out and speak with voters. So right now, that is what we've been doing, trying to strategize how to get out there and engage with voters. So at this point, we are trying to get access to VAN, which is the Voter Access Network, which will just tell us the registered Democratic voters. But then also a big focus of mine is getting in touch with politically disengaged communities, because ultimately in a race such as this, voter turnout is going to be essentially everything, because we have to get people who are out of touch with politics because they don't think it works for them. We have to get them to see that now we have someone who's going to run for us. Now you have a voice, so your vote will matter. So that's pretty much the stage that we're at now. Day to day is just trying to figure out what events can we go to reach people? Where can we go to canvass? I mean, I've already been canvassing at shopping malls, at bus stops, at stores. I've just been going out just talking to people because we don't have access to the voter access network as of yet. That's where we're at right now in the campaign.
And what's been the response by people when you go out and talk to them? I assume the average response is Steny who, you know, it's like usually these people have been in there for 40 years, you know, they're not doing a lot of events back in the district.
So actually, it's been kind of a mix. For the very most part, the people who do know who Steny Hoyer is, they're like, yeah, he's how old now? They're like, yeah, it's time for him to go. He's out of touch. You know, and I'll talk to them about my ideas and they'll just be like, yeah. Because a lot of people, even though they vote, just because you vote does not mean that you're politically engaged or connected. Sometimes people just vote because that's just what it's been. They see the same name on the ballot every year. It's like, check, you know, because that's who you know. But some people don't actually know some of the policies that he supports or doesn't support that hurts us. So it's like when I talk to them and I talk to them about like mass incarceration and I'm like, you know, he voted for the 1994 crime bill. And they're like, really? And I'm like, yeah, he most definitely did. And I talk to them about Medicare for All. And when I explain to them what it is, and they're like, he's against that? And I'm like, yes, he is. So it's really just like educating people at the same time. But once I have the conversation with them, it's completely 100% positive. I've been meeting with people who say that they're registered to vote, but they don't want to vote because they don't have anyone to speak for them and they feel like they don't matter. But once I tell them my life story, like I was talking to these group of kids and I was telling them my whole life story and everything that I've been through. And the one guy was like, wow. He was like, I really, you know, generally don't vote. He was like, but I'll vote for you because you're just like us. That's what it's about. And it really touched me when he said that because I was like, this is why I'm doing it. Like, that's exactly the reason why. So to answer your question of what the response is, it's been very supportive. Maybe like one or two people were like, we like him because he's been around for so long. I did have one guy actually tell me he's not perfect, but no one's perfect. He said, we're surviving. And I told him, I was like, well, people with cancer are surviving. Just because you're surviving doesn't mean that you're thriving. So yeah, he really brushed me off. I was just like, okay.
That's a really good answer to him though. I really like that. Are you running into any trouble because of the DCC blacklist? The vendor blacklist?
Actually, we have. When we first started out and we first announced around the time when Warrior made his comments at APAC, we were calling around to videographers, political videographers, and we were like essentially everyone like didn't want to really help us. And we had one person who did volunteer to help us. He was going to do it for free. I was like, yes. But he was told by his employer that they were not allowed to engage in any political activities with us, pretty much. So we actually had to find a videographer that didn't usually do political work, but it turned out good. The videos were great. And recently we've been trying to find someone to handle all of our FEC filings, our quarterly reports, and reaching out to some of the consulting firms, we were continuously told that they were, quote, at capacity. But we knew what it was. But we did find someone actually the other day that we've been working with. So they are going to help us out with our FEC filings. Because of how national this race is and because Steny Hoyer is such a horrible person and he's so widely known and he is a leader in the House, I don't really feel like the DCCC blacklist will really hurt this race as bad, but it kind of makes me worry about other primary challengers and lesser known races, which is why I have been working with other candidates, just trying to amplify them. Actually, someone, because they had noticed that I was retweeting a lot of other candidates, and they said, "Are you guys the Progressive Avengers?"
And I was like, well, that's great.
if you want to call us that. But it's just like for things like them, like I've been speaking with Joshua Collins, who's running against Denny Heck in Washington's 10th congressional district. Mm-hmm. And then also Anthony Clark, who's running against Danny K. Davis in Illinois' 7th district. They've been really helpful. So I just have been trying to work with other primary challengers who just need that extra voice.
That's such a interesting aspect of this, which is the
infrastructure that's building up around these progressive challenges. So yes, the most famous one is Justice Dems.
So I'd be interested in hearing, have these, you know, DSA, Our Revolution, Justice Dems, and even these interesting policy figures that are starting to give policy advice to candidates like you, how has the growing national infrastructure helped you, any of these organizations?
I would say for the most part, BNC has been very helpful.
That's brand new Congress for listeners, right?
Yes.
I'm the acronym expander.
Brand new Congress has been very helpful. I'm not officially endorsed by them, but I love their network. They have like a team, like a slate of nominees, and all the way up until, I guess, the part if they decide whether or not they're going to endorse you. But they provide like a backbone for you. So it's like all of us nominees, we have each other to lean on. And we also have the brand new Congress team to lean on, to come to them for support for policy questions, policy ideas. And we also have the nominees to lean on if we need any kind of support, whether it's support with your campaign, emotional support, if you know stuff is going on, you know, if you're getting stressed out, and also support for resources. Like when I couldn't find someone to do my FAC filings for, I went to, you know, the brand new Congress nominees and then also some volunteers. And, you know, we were able to connect on that to ask for resources. So they've been very helpful. I love them for that. As far as the other organizations, I've only spoken to Justice Democrats a couple times. I'm not really sure where they're at right now with selecting candidates at this moment, but it's basically been just on a conversational level with them. I've also been speaking with Our Revolution, with our local Maryland chapter, not necessarily the national chapter as of yet, but they've been helpful as far as on the local level with having me come out and speak about, you know, Medicare for All, coming to their rallies and backing me in that way. But I have been speaking with other organizations briefly, with like DSA and DFA. Nothing set in stone yet, just in the conversing stages of it at this point. So yeah.
The election is next April.
Yes, April the 28th.
Some ways away, but good to get those endorsements.
Yes. I was recently endorsed, actually yesterday, by an up-and-coming firm called Young Pack, who strives to help get young progressives elected in office.
Congrats on that. The first of many, hopefully.
Yes.
It's interesting, this idea of emotional support. It's something we as voters don't appreciate, that it's very hard to run for office. And it makes me think about if there's like a, I'm taking on the Democratic Establishment Anonymous group that you can join. Talk about the travails of that.
Yeah, it's there if you need it.
Part of it is who you are as a candidate, but part of it is who you're taking on that helps you. You know, AOC was helped a bit by Joe Crowley being, he was a little rusty after not having a challenger for a long time. Is that what you expect with Congressman Hoyer? And what is it about him specifically that made you want to take him on?
To be honest, I don't sleep on Steny Hoyer. He may not have had, you know, as many challenges or credible primary challengers. I think that at this moment, I think that he knows that I'm here and it's not a game. He knows that I'm coming and I'm coming hard. I don't want to underestimate him. I mean, he's a horrible person. He's interfered with other people's races. I heard that he had interfered, had something to do with Amy Villela's race. And then the other guy that The Intercept released a recording of him telling him to drop out of the race. So I definitely don't put anything past him. But I just believe that he is an absolute horrible person.
I'm so glad to hear that so openly. That's great. I'm so glad that you're saying it.
Yeah, I think that he is horrible. And when you're out here and you're talking to people, it's just like a look in their eyes that almost brought me to tears, because it's just people who just really feel like they are forgotten. Like they want housing. They want healthcare. I've spoken with homeless people. All they want is a shelter. You know, they don't want to sleep outside. And when you look at our current representation, speaking of Staney Hoyer, it's just like, you are gambling with people's lives. You're gambling with their lives and you're gambling with their livelihood, all for the sake of your pocketbook. Why? You know, this is not right. It's absolutely not right. And that's why I say he is a horrible person. He is a very horrible person, because at the end of the day, a checkbook does not erase morality. You have to live with yourself at the end of the day. And for him to be able to live with these decisions of not supporting Medicare for All, of not supporting the Green New Deal, of not pushing hard to end the war on drugs that disproportionately affects Black and Brown people, that is a problem. You're going to have to live with that. And the fact that he can live with that at this moment and he's just happy with his checkbook, all happy go gilly, says a lot about him. He's ruthless. It's no longer, I don't even know, was it ever about the people with him? I mean, at this point, like, we need somebody that's for us. And that's part of the other reason why I'm running, because I'm mad as hell. Because this is someone that we voted for. This is someone who wins. He's been winning for the past 20 terms. The past 20 terms. You know these people are counting on you and you're doing nothing about it. And that's why he's horrible.
Yeah, he's been in office since 81, which is crazy. It's longer than any of us here talking today have been alive.
Yes. 10 years before I was born.
One thing that strikes me about your campaign in the way that you're answering this is, you know, you are in campaigning rejecting, you know, a certain form of electoral, what they call respectability politics, which is that the normal kind of quote unquote respectable way to run is you hide all of the true stories about your life that some people might think are bad. You tailor your kind of personality and affect to the normal kind of establishment way you talk. You talk about differences as, you know, a happy hunky-dory difference between you and the other, especially in a primary. You're not doing that. You're saying, here's who I am, here's my whole life, and here's exactly what I think about what's going on. Was that a conscious decision, or is that just the only way you can run?
It's not even the only way that I can run. It's just how I am. Like, that's who I am. Like, I'm real. I'm 100%. I'm transparent. I've always been that way. How I'm running is how I would wish that anyone else would run that is in office, because we need that transparency. I need that in my elected official, because I want to be able to trust you. I want to be able to know that you care about what's going on. I don't want it to be a situation, you know, I won't name any names, but I don't want it to be a situation, you know, like in the recent cases in Virginia where you've been in office for these years and then bam, we found out in college you're doing blackface, you know?
We'll name the names. It's our governor. I'm a Virginian. I'll name the names. That's our governor.
I mean, but seriously, like, it all boils down to give people a choice if they want to support you. Because once you hide information from people, you are taking their choice away.
Maryland's 5th has been reliably Democratic for a long, long time, right?
Yes.
It's been a stronghold. Hoyer is won by, like, these huge chunks of the vote.
Yes.
But without real challengers every time.
Yeah. Yes.
That's really wild. So one of the reasons that Hoyer has been in the news lately is that he has been really shitty about climate change. He is the person who blocked AOC's special panel on climate change from having subpoena power. Climate change is a real signature issue for you, and I just wanted to get a little bit more of your perspective on it. You proposed something really, really cool, not just a Green New Deal, but also a climate refugees plan.
Yes.
Yeah, tell us more.
So the Green New Deal is important for me, especially because we live in Maryland. We are on the coast. And we pride ourselves on our environmentalism. Why are we not leading on the issue of climate change? And with Hoyer, he stresses we have a climate crisis. Well, then support the Green New Deal then. You know, we are the state of the Chesapeake Bay. Why are you not leading on this? I mean, hypothetical question, because we know why he's not leading on it, because, you know, look at his donors, but whatever. But, you know, this is a serious issue in all seriousness, because regular people who bear the brunt of climate change are the ones who contribute the least to it. And that's just not fair, which brought me and my team to put together what we call the Teeming Shore Promise, which is helping other areas with coastal resilience so that they can be prepared for natural disasters, and so that not only will they be prepared, but they can be able to bounce back from that. And I did propose for refugees to be expanded to victims of climate change, for them to be considered as refugees to come over here. I've gotten a little bit of negative feedback about that. Oh, well, we can't deal with the people we have here, which is very, very negative. And I've even heard that from a few Democrats as well, which is very disheartening. But what people fail to realize is that this is these people's homes. No one wants to get up and leave their whole life to come to another country, especially while Donald Trump is president. Pretty sure they don't want to come here, you know? So that's why we have to focus on coastal resilience so that they can bounce back. And then not only that, our intake of refugees, it's slow right now. We're not taking in as many refugees. So we can absolutely do it. We're facing a lot. We're facing the loss of coastal lands, homes, and infrastructure to rising sea levels, specifically in Maryland. We're facing power outages, flooding, and damage to homes and businesses from bigger storms and extreme precipitation. And climate change will ultimately lead to the ocean becoming more acidic, which will harm our fish, oyster, and crab population. I don't know if you know, but Maryland, we like to eat some crab.
I got Old Bay at my house.
Yes. We're facing the reverse of the Chesapeake Bay restoration efforts, which have been going on my entire life. So just climate change is just very important. And we need to make the efforts to mitigate it a reality and stop it with the whole it's a myth. You know, stop it with the half measures. Think Hoyer had wanted to pass something for flooding for after the fact, some bill he wanted to pass. But it's like, you know, we need something to prevent that. How about you support the Green New Deal? Maybe we can prevent some floodings, you know? That is just really important to me that that's getting done. Because at the end of the day, what do all of these policies matter if the world is not here to endure them?
Amen. One question on strategy, and then we'll wrap up soon, is that from what I'm looking at, it seems like Maryland's fifth congressional district is 40% non-white. And that makes me think that it's Democratic primary. The congressional district of Democrats is probably majority non-white. How does that dynamic play out, given that, you know, it's represented by a white guy who's been there since 1981?
I do believe that is going to be something that we're going to have to struggle with. Unfortunately, in my humblest opinion, I believe that our district is highly gerrymandered. And again, it's unofficial, but the same elected official that tried to convince me to drop out of the race, I don't know if she meant to tell me this, but she came out and said that they had helped to draw the map for District 5. And I told her, I said, yeah, I said, well, then you know that District 5 is gerrymandered. She said, well, that depends on what you define as gerrymandered. Like, are you kidding me? But race aside, we all have the same issues. And like I said before, it's all going to come down to increasing voter turnout. Because that is going to be the brunt of this race, is to get people out. Because our districts, our demographics are highly changing in this area. They're changing very rapidly. So it's all about just getting out there, getting people to register to vote in this district, connecting with people in this district who think that the government does not work for them, who think that our current representation is out of touch. It's all about getting out there. And then also, we had a guy, his name is Dennis Fritz. He ran last election in the last primary. He lost, but I will say this, he had no platform. Because to him, like literally his platform was the people was his platform. He got 15% of the vote with no platform. If that doesn't show that Maryland District 5 is ready for change, I don't know what is. It's all about getting out there and letting people know. Because I can't tell you how many people didn't even know about Dennis Fritz until after he lost. and said that if they had known about him, they would have voted for him just to get Hoyer out. So like I said, it's going to take a lot of groundwork, a lot of getting out, educating people, letting people know the facts, and just getting their trust and letting them know that this is happening. We need to get Hoyer up out of there.
So, Michaela, what does your campaign need right now? What can our listeners do to support you?
Well, if you guys want to help me out, Definitely. Of course, we need donations. This is a grassroots campaign. I'm not taking any money from any corporate PACs. So I'm going to need the people to help me out on this. And I'm not taking money from any corporate PACs because whoever gives you money, you owe them. I don't want to owe anybody but the people. Point blank, period. If anyone wants to donate to my campaign, you can donate at www.michaela2020.com. All of my social media handles are at Meet Michaela. If you can't donate, spread the word, spread it like crazy. Retweet, share, everything. To say that, my name is spelled M-C-K-A-Y-L-A.
There is an old union phrase, when we fight, we win. And you remind me of that phrase because you're fighting and you're going to win. Can't wait to be part of the everyone across the country celebrating in April next year when you continue this wonderful trend, bringing a new generation with a bold vision into our Congress. Thank you.
Thank you guys for having me. I enjoy speaking with you.